coming Sunday, you'll be starting with this book. I don't know how long we'll stay in the book. Because, let's see, March, April, May, we'll be out of school before you get the year out of the quarter.
People will have to bring it up.
But perhaps even if we don't finish, at least you have a full set of the notes that I have in the way I teach it. What you have here, your quarterly, your Bible, and your healthy thumb. One thing that you'll have here that you probably won't draw from the quarterly quite as much is quite a bit of introductory background material to Ezekiel. The book of Ezekiel starts out, and you as young preachers, I hope you'll really get this, because every time I come across this part, it really pulls at the string. How long have you been in the ministry, brother?
Since 1960.
Business at hand here. And I am going to try, because there's some notes here. I'm going to try to look up there and see that thing. That is Ezekiel right there in the middle, isn't it? Get your notes open. Get the book open. That's one thing I like about this class, fellas. You got this recorder going, brother?
Yes.
Okay. Want to make sure here. The word rolls. Spend most of the time that we got left in this book, if that's suitable with you fellas. One of the things about Ezekiel, as I said, this thing will pull at your heartstrings here in these first few chapters when we realize who Ezekiel is, his age, the events that are about to take place. You remember Ezekiel was born during quite a time. He was a member of one of the best, perhaps noblest families of that particular time. And probably born somewhere during this particular time here, about the same time. Now remember, this was the boy king, the child king. Started ruling. This fella here was probably one of the most wicked kings they had, reigned for 52 years. At the time that he was taken captive, we can just back up a little bit, and from here, at this particular point in time, and just go backwards 25 years. So, means he was born somewhere during this particular time, right in through here. The reason we say that is because we know that he was 25 years old when he was taken captive. So, that means about 623, somewhere right along in there. Is when he was born. Now, Ezekiel is laid out as a very easy book to follow, because everything is dated for you through the book. And he was from a good family, a noble family. He was a descendant of the family of Zadok, I suggest you underline that. I'll probably ask you that. Who was he a descendant of? And that was Zadok. And you should start right there and underline that whole thing. And it should be underlined already for you, but you might want to highlight it again. And I might just tell you this, at any time, since it's a copy of my notes, anytime you see an underline with a little T out there on the side, that's Ted. Probably could have told you that, but at least you'll know to look at that particular area a little closer. Now, Zadok could trace his descent directly back to Aaron. So this is a priestly family. Now, during the reign of Josiah, what was the conditions in Israel or in Judah at that particular time? Now, what had happened under Josiah? Josiah found the book of the law. He had the temple cleaned up. And there had seemingly been a moral reform. But what happened on the death of Josiah? Okay, what's the proof of a revival, Brother Jackson? Is it while the evangelist is there or when he's going home?
Must be, because that's the way it is today.
So it really shows here that the people, instead of really turning back to God, what were they doing? I'm talking about the nation as a whole. Now, they were some. There were a few that stayed with God. But they were following the king, because these next group of fellows here just went from bad to worse, right on down the line. Okay. So we already mentioned to you about Jeremiah now with the captives. We covered that last week. Anybody have any questions, anything you need your mind refreshed on? Because we may pop a few questions now, because we want you to keep in mind that Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel were contemporaries. They're just in different areas, okay? Where was Jeremiah? Okay. And upon the captivity, where was he left? They took him out north of town there, and one time. But when the captivity came, he was taken out, and they was leading him out of town there, and when the captives and them joined up out there at Mizpah, what'd they do? They didn't want him, so they left him there, and he joined the colony at Mizpah. And his last prophecy, he was accused of getting it from where? Even though the people said, boy, we sure glad you stayed behind. At least we got a prophet. And I just hear, boy, what you said was good, Jeremiah. You proved it. You was the prophet of God. Just patting him on the back. We sure glad to have you down here, you good Baptist preacher. We've heard so much about you. We're going to have you over tonight for, I started to say, some ham and eggs, but I don't think they would invite Jeremiah for ham and eggs. Maybe some fried chicken, maybe. But, they accused him of getting his prophecy from who?
Right.
So there he is. Now Ezekiel's over here on the river Kabar, and Daniel led out in this last one. See, Daniel was taken out in that first captivity. See it right here? On the first attack when Nebuchadnezzar came, Daniel and them. Then Ezekiel on the second one, and then this last one here was the fall of Jerusalem, and this is the one where Jeremiah was finally ended up out here. Well, I don't know. Daniel probably was the one that if we were talking about material things, it probably fared more sumptuously every day, actually living in the king's palace. These Jeremiah and Ezekiel, I don't think had it too well. Being left behind, Daniel probably had it as far as food and raiment. Probably had it pretty good, because if you read in the first chapters of Daniel, you find that he was given a king's portion, even though they refused it. It was their portion if he wanted it.
So the contemporaries of Daniel and Jeremiah.
Yes, and then there's a few others that fall in this. And to Zephaniah, although his prophecy is very short, Nahum was about this time, but Nahum's prophecy is directed strictly to Nineveh. See, here's Mizpa, right here. And when they fled out, and then they joined up, and this is where Jeremiah ended up, was here at Mizpa. Yeah, Brother Ray?
The first chapter is over here.
Well, I explain yourself. Maybe I'm not following. You mean three attacks on the city? Is that what you mean of Jerusalem? The final one was 585. This is when he came back and actually leveled the city. It's actually three attacks on the city by Nebuchadnezzar. Maybe that's what you're having reference to. The first one was right here, about 570. And this is when Daniel, the three Hebrew children, this is when he took the chief one, the brain. He took the princes and the astrologers and all of the chief men. And then the next time he come back, he took the brawn, the muscles, you might say, the guys to do the hard labor. And this was Ezekiel. And the reason he came back, I think he would have probably pretty much left him alone right here, but some of his little puppet kings that he set up over there, they got fooling around them and got to look into Egypt. He thought they was going to rebel. So this last attack, he leveled the city. That's when he stripped the 585. The first one was 585. That's when, I keep forgetting, you got to look at this thing, we're going down instead of going up. So excuse me, the first one was 585, the last one's been on down here about 560 something.
That's Jeremiah.
Well, he was there the whole time, underneath all of it, but it was in this final one when Jerusalem was completely destroyed. I mean, they tore the thing apart, he ransacked the temple. It describes it there, how he stripped it. I mean, he actually went into the chapters and stripped the gold and ornaments right off the wall.
You know, I thought it
was pretty ready. Daniel, Ezekiel, and then the final one when he destroyed it.
And that's it. 65.
About that period of time. Daniel and the three Hebrew children, along with the princes and all of that, went out in the first one under the first attack. 585.
And
then about 575 or so, he comes back again. And this is it's hard to, some of my dates that I have don't coincide exactly with what he's got up here on this here, but I have that the final attack came upon in 585, and this here don't quite jive with what I have, because I always thought that this first attack came right around 600, the next one at 597, and the final one at 585, and that's the way I'm going to stick with it, because that's what I got in my head. That's the way I'm going to keep it, because that's the way I've got it in my notes, and that's the way that most of the books and scholars and stuff that I looked at have put it out. He was born in 622. 25 years later, he was taken captive. That was in 597. And I think history will bear it out.
597.
Oh, okay. I see. The thing that got me confused. Okay. This right here, he's got 575 BC. But then right here, he's got 600 BC. So that's right.
You've got one over after the other.
That's what got me all messed up. There we go. Now, that makes it a whole lot clearer. I was trying to look through two vellums there. There you go. Now you see it. Now, that final attack came in 585. That was the whole thing that was throwing him. You guys kept asking me when the first attack with Daniel and him just before 600. This one here, about 597, we can pinpoint that pretty accurately.
I thought Daniel and him were fairly late after 600.
Very early. Uh-huh. It was before the year 600. It was quite a, in other words, these attacks, he didn't go bang and come back next week and bang again. It was several periods of years at least. Now, this one here was 597, this is 585, so there's 12 years there that
the first attack was
here. Well, it's really hard to say exactly right to the date, but let's see if I got that down here. I would think about, let me turn over here to my notes on Daniel and see if I don't have that down here. Well, three different sets of people led out. It's all part of the same captivity, the Babylonian captivity, but it's just three different times that he came on the city.
Well, the 70-year captivity, is that one of them?
This is the 70-year captivity. Starts from right there. This is just three different attacks on the same city. No, two different groups of people. The Assyrians were a part of the old northern kingdom, which they don't have a map in here, but the Mediterranean was Jerusalem about here, and the northern, what was known as Israel up here and what was known as Judah down here. Babylon from here was about, from Jerusalem was about 700 miles way down here on the, where the Persian Gulf comes in. Whereas the Assyrian Empire, Nineveh, was way back up in this area. I would say that roughly that first attack would have been about 610, 612, somewhere along in that area. I don't see it here in my notes, but I'll get it for you. We'll pin for you.
It's about 596. You guys have heard the thing up here. It's about 2 years
interval. Mm-hmm. 10 to 12 years interval.
Of course, this is a lot already.
All right, go ahead.
He gives a reference here.
He goes
about
in that first attack.
All right.
Give or take a month or two. So this first attack would be about 612, 597, 585 on the final destroyer. 612? Yeah, they're right here. 612, 597, 585. So it's the same attack, it's just that because, like you said, the rebellion of the ones that he left there as kings, he had to come back and put it down. They were already a suppressed and captured people, but these were just, what would we say, skirmishes within the war. But in 585, he so defeated them that time, they didn't do anything again until 70, until Ezra and Nehemiah came in. Okay, he was born in the year 622, about 20 years younger than Jeremiah. Remember I said he was contemporary, but he's about 20 years younger than Jeremiah. At the time he was born, Jeremiah about 20 years old. So he became very familiar being a member of the family priest and all that. He became very familiar, you know, with all the rituals and things of that around Judaism. But he was an infant in arms when Josiah's Reformation was sweeping the outward signs of idolatry out of Judah. And so he's just been a small boy during that time. So at the death of Josiah, he was actually raised up, we could say, as a teenager in his more formative years under all of this rebellion and so on. Probably one of the reasons that he was not taken captive along with Daniel and him is that he wasn't considered a man yet. He'd still been very young as a teenager during that particular time. It is clear from his prophecies that Ezekiel had steeped himself in the priestly tradition. He had learned all the details of the holy duties to which he looked forward. Now here, to me, is one of the heartbreaking things. However, his whole course of life was rudely interrupted when at the age of 25, 597 B.C., he was taken captive to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, why would that so abruptly interrupt his life? I mean, have you know his name? What a young man in the priesthood, what about 25? That's when he entered his training, wasn't it? Trained for 5 years, and at 30 he began. So right at the time that he was getting ready to enter seminary, which they will call it that for lack of a better word, I don't know exactly, but they went into training, they went into schooling for 5 years. Right at that time, the whole course of his life was interrupted. Now this is no doubt. Yeah, I'm talking about Ezekiel now. Who do you think we're studying?
Well, I know.
Right there. Studies in what? Major prophecy. Then you can read down here. Subject. Introduction to who? Yeah, we're talking about Ezekiel. So his hope of ever becoming an active priest was cut off. Now, later on, Ezekiel witnesses a very, very sad thing. Now, he may have hoped for a very early return to Jerusalem. Turn to Jeremiah 29 and 8 and read that. His life must have lost, seemingly for him as a young man, must have seemingly lost a lot of meaning about that time. Young man, 25, just getting ready to embark his life to run here as a priest. Jeremiah 29 and 8. Somebody read that for us.
Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, let not your prophets and your diviners be in the midst of you, see you. For your heart is in your veins, which you call us to be.
And we need some other verses in there, I think. Just a minute.
Okay. And what about 10? For thus saith the Lord, that after 7 years be accomplished in Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word towards you and cause you to return to this place.
Okay. Yeah. See, the prophets were prophesying falsely. You need to include in that verses 8, 9, and 10. Right. So write that on down there in your notes so you'll have it next time you go through it. Any hope for an early return? See, Jeremiah already prophesied at least 70 years. Now, here's a man 25 years old, and if he's going into captivity for 70 years, that's going to make him 95. So you see, just about any hope that he ever had for active priestly service is gone. Now, that would be kind of disturbing to me, I think. Would it to you, Brother Ray? But say, for an example, some of you fellas, fourth year students, now you're graduating, you're planning to do various things. Brother Ray to go back to Australia, Brother Hurst to go to New Zealand. Say and pray it don't happen. But say the communist Chinese or communist Russia come in here and said, Brother Hurst, you stay right here. And Brother Ray, we're not going to allow you to return. How would that affect your life? Be kind of disappointed, wouldn't it? Be kind of heartbreaking. So this is the situation that Ezekiel finds himself in. However, Jeremiah's letter of the fate of Ahab and Zedekiah reveals that there was no hope for his return to serve the Lord as priest in his temple. If you go on and you continue reading in that chapter, I think it's very evident. Verse 10 mentions the fact that, like you said, he's going to be 70 years. Verse 21 on over there, he talks about how that his sons and so on rebelled. He said, I will deliver them to the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and he shall slay them before your eyes. And that's what happened. They got Zedekiah, and they killed his sons, and then they put out his eyes and led him away captive. So any hope that seems to have vanished away. Now, at 30, Ezekiel realized that the sin of his people had cut him off from his spiritual heritage. And that must have been kind of a rude, sad awakening, too. And no doubt there would have been a very strong, mixed emotions at that particular time for Ezekiel, because I love America. I love American people. Now, there's the thing about America, when you say you love America and her people, you're talking about red and yellow, black and white. You're talking about people from German descent, Dutch descent, Australian, English, African, Mexican. They're here from all over. So when you say you love America, you're just about saying you love people from all walks of life. But with Ezekiel, that was not true. He's talking about his own people. I mean, a people that basically has been kept pretty pure. There had been some intermarriage in the northern kingdom, but because of that, remember, the two kingdoms had split. That southern kingdom had, as far as the marriage and up until Manasseh, had stayed pretty good in that area. But he realizes all of a sudden that these people that he had hoped to serve as priests are the very ones that are responsible for him being where he's at. Now, then God comes along and calls him to be the prophet. I might say, wait a minute, Lord. Now, I was just getting ready to enter into that priesthood. And now look at me. Here I'm sitting way over here on the river Kabar, 500-600 miles away from home. And Jeremiah's already said we're going to be here 70 years. My life's shot. My plans are gone. And if you want me to go back and help them people, telling people to hang it in their ears, but it's modern day language, you know. Tell them, lump it. And I could imagine as a human being, you know, Jeremiah had afterthoughts like that, didn't he? I don't preach to them guys. Let them die. Go ahead. I'm just going to shut up. And you can get somebody else prophesy to them. And so we can get that way sometimes. I'll tell you what, there's been times, man, you've poured out your heart to the congregation, you've pastored people for several years, and then all of a sudden, one that you had a lot of confidence in will just, man. And you just give your first impulse, just go over his house and knock on the door, and when he answers it, just boom, right between the eyes. And just walk off, you know. Brother Patterson, I remember when I was going to take my first church, I said, Brother Dwyer, I said, you got any advice for me about how to handle some of the members? And I was really scared because this first church I was going to, I knew two people in it. And one was an older preacher in his 70s, and he wasn't able to pastor, and that kind of frightened me a little bit because I had known him ever since I was a baby. And then the other fellow I had met a couple times before, and he was 60, and he's 60, and he is a deacon. And so I could just see these two big burly guys just taking me up one side and down the other. So they did. But Brother Patterson said, well, he said, I suggested on the way up to Washington that you stop off in Oregon and buy you a double-barrel shotgun. And I thought, for what? My first thought was that he's going to tell me to do a lot of hunting while I'm up there. And he said, just preach the first Sunday, and if it looks like those two fellas are going to give you a hard time, he said, just go knock on the door. When they answer the door, don't say, hello, how are you, amen, good to see you, but just point the gun at their head and pull the trigger and go home and tell God they died. So I can imagine that Ezekiel may have kind of felt that way. And even though it may not be recorded quite that harshly, I think as we go through Ezekiel in some of the areas, you can see where Ezekiel's spirit is really poured out to these people who he is called to serve. And so under these adverse circumstances, Ezekiel's still a prophet of God. And this fellow has helped me a lot of times. Jeremiah and Ezekiel have studied these prophets. It's helped me to draw strength, to just hang in there. You know, when you think things, you just, boy, it couldn't possibly get any worse. I don't know, how would you like to preach under these kind of conditions? You know? Let me ask you something, Brother Mark. Now, I understand your father is Catholic, right? But he hasn't threatened your life yet because you've become a Baptist preacher, has he? I mean, your wife hasn't plotted with him to get rid of you, or at least not to your... Well, in Jeremiah's case, that happened. You see, his own family sought to murder him. In fact, he had to get out of town. And the very place he longed to be, he was forbidden to even go in there. But yet these men, you get like Jeremiah. I've had several young preachers say, how do you know when the Lord's calling you to preach? And I always have them read that part of Jeremiah where Jeremiah said that I'm not going to prophesy and preach anymore. He said, but thy words begin to burn within me and I could not hold my peace. And that's what I tell you, young fellas, come and ask me that. If you can do anything else and be happy, do it. But if all you can do is preach the word, you can't hold your peace, then you better get busy preaching. And that's one of the marks of a true prophet and a true preacher. A true preacher is going to preach. He's not going to be satisfied sitting on the bench with somebody else do it all the time. So the book doubtless came from Ezekiel's own hand, written and completed by himself. It is in many respects the most orderly, the most logical, and most chronological of all the books of the Bible. In fact, that it sets all the dates. Almost every distinct prophecy is dated so that we can have the exact date, the month, and the year. So that's why it helps if we know that Ezekiel was taken in the year 597. Because he gives us the date, the month, and all of that. And so it helps us to set the times and dates for some of the other books and his contemporaries. Now, all of those scriptures, I'm going to take time to turn and read all of those, but that list of scriptures there under 3b is just a list of where he names dates and months and this type of thing in it, and introduces prophecies. Now, we'll get some of those as we go on through the outline, so don't take time to thumb through your Bible and look them up right now. I just collected them all together in this one place for you. But the following is analysis of Ezekiel. It's just a brief shot at it, all right? And then we'll go into the book. So this is kind of an overall outline, and then we'll go into to break it down. First of all, chapters 1 through 3 is the vision of the glory of God and the call to the prophetic office. These first three chapters give us some heavenly glimpses, tell us how that a young man was transformed from just a young man getting ready to enter the priesthood to a prisoner captive that was transformed into a great prophet of God. And there's an example that God can use you in any situation, Brother Hurst, if you're ready and willing to be used.
Is this your opinion, Jesus, the
author? You mean in this second, third chapter? Yeah, I believe it's the theophany. Yeah. You mean the Lord?
Yes.
The pre-incarnate Christ?
Yeah.
I sure do. since I believe that Jesus Christ, the scripture plainly teaches in the New Testament that he is the outward manifestation of the glory of God. Since no man has seen the Father, I have no other choice to believe that these were glimpses of the pre-incarnate Son. I think it's the same one that Abraham talked to, and I think it's the same one that Daniel saw, and Isaiah saw, and on down through scripture. I think it's the same one that Jacob wrestled with. Right on down through scripture. They refer to him as the Lord. Okay. Now, from chapter 4 to 24, you really get into the where the rubber meets the road, because it's the prophecy of doom. Chapters 4 through 7, just his opening message. Might say this is just an introduction. Can we put it today in our sermon? It's just his introduction to his message. Chapters 8 through 19, I want you to notice the length and the amount of space he takes here to tell these people of their sin. I want us to know that as we go through the book how he really lays it out. And Ezekiel introduces something that none of the other prophets have covered. The other prophets dealt with the nation as a nation and pointed to national sin. Ezekiel introduces a whole new train of thought. That is the one of each individual's responsibility. You are a watchman. If you don't sound the warning, if you don't, the blood. In other words, Israel as a nation has gifted us. So now he's going to the individual and pointing a finger in everybody's face right around the thing. And this is a new concept. You don't find this in the other prophets. Ezekiel, though, deals with that one of human responsibility. And then he gets in chapter 20, 21, 22, and 23. He really deals with a deeper meaning of sin. Of course, chapter 24 is an imminent judgment, which carries us well on over into not only this particular time, but we're going to see that he carried us on over into the tribulation and deals with the end time also. From chapter 25 on down through chapter 32, he deals with some of the contemporary nations, some of the Palestine's neighbors, and we'll discuss those. Pretty heavy things said about Tyre and Egypt, some of those. Then we get into the part of Ezekiel that I really like to study, because we go from a doomsday and sin type thing to God's promise, his love, his restoration, and some wonderful prophecies here throughout these chapters, his own function, the ruler's past and future. Then he deals with the land and the people, chapter 35, 36, and 37, where we go and he sees the valley of dry bones. See the rebirth of Israel. I think the reason why we like this is because we've seen this prophecy literally take shape in our own lifetime, haven't we? And of course, chapter 38 and 39, you know, at the close of World War II, it wouldn't have took the United States but about another month of fighting, and we could have had Russia too if we wanted it. That's how weak and how poor they were. But now we take an all-out scale war, and I'm not so sure that we might not get lit if we challenge the communist world on our own right now. We're outnumbered. About the Chinese alone outnumber us about 8-1. And so you add all of that together, that means for just if they alone come, their army, their standing army, outnumbers ours 4-1. So, I don't know. Sir.
World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I was 53 cylinders, 30 minutes of World War II. And I was rushing units, and they took over the town.
Mm-hmm.
And who are you like? You didn't shoot me before. I mean, you're
well, I think that the historians are finally waking up to the fact that Mr. FDR just about sold us down the drain. A lot of his other policies, though they look good at the time, that he's greatly responsible for some of the social messes we're in today. A lot of, he has your opinion, but I think the Lord took him at the right time. Had he had lived in the victory, I'm sure that this country would have probably had elected him for another term, and we would have all been little Roosevelt ice right now. And this country, though it may not have been ceased to be in communism, I think we've been moving into a very strong socialist, stronger than what we are now. Because if you go back and read his policies and things during his life, and some of the talk that he had with Stalin and so on, he just leaned too heavy in that direction.
I never understood why.
Well, it's not the first time the United States has given others a free hand and then got slapped at that hand. It's happened again and again. One of the most current times is Vietnam. They're still slapping. They're sitting over there laughing at us as they march across Cambodia and right on. And I'm sure that you see a lot of the talk right now. Russia says that we gave China the word to go ahead. I think China planned it that way to get us in trouble with Russia. I hate to think that our president gave Mr. King an okay to go ahead and attack Vietnam. I think it's about time that America fought our own battle.
Well, I was my 12, 13 years old, comrades. They were going to meetings and they were, you know,
I was. Everybody said, oh, it's just a passing fad. You know, Karl Marx wrote a book, so what? And everybody thought it would pass.
Yeah.
Lenin was looked on as a revolutionary, somebody would bump off, and when he's dead, his movement will stop. But it kept going.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen the revival of these two great countries, haven't we? Russia came from a backward 10th rate nation until now is considered what we refer to as one of the big four. In other words, when World Summit meetings are called, that's one of the governments that's always included. And we see that in chapter 38 and 39 and some other translations. Of course, King James, you can draw it from there, but some of the other translations make it very plain about and include the word Rosh. Some of the ancient manuscripts have that word in there, R-O-S-H. And when we get to that chapter, we'll outline the plan for you. And I hope maybe I can find some maps. So the last part is the vision of the restored temple. Fellas, this is great, these chapters. Good material in here. There's one sermon over there that I like to use every once in a while, especially in revival meetings. Water to swim. Well, no, it's on over there in the temple. We'll wait till we get there. I won't give it to you this morning. You don't need to preach at this time, do you? Oh, it's a good one, fellas. If you haven't preached it, it makes good preaching. Water to swim in, where he saw the restoration of the temple. And it's in chapter 40.
To the school of temple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he was bringing him into that temple area, and he brought me into the inner court, verse 32, toward the east, and he measured the gate according to the little measure. Let me see exactly where it is. I don't want to read this whole chapter. I thought I had it underlined. It's in my other Bible.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not 40,
is it? No, it's in this last part here. I thought, yeah, here it is, over in 47. I just had to keep turning. I knew I had it underlined here.
Yeah, I got it underlined.
Yeah, the river that flows out in the sanctuary, the thing that I
just some of the things in verse 1, note the source of it, where it came from. And then as he began to walk out past the temple eastward, ran along the right side, so you know what river this is. This is that one that's running down the En Gedi to give life to the Dead Sea. See? The one that comes right out from the threshold there, I think from that rock itself there on Mount Moriah. That's where the threshold of the temple is at. Isn't that right, Brother Phil? Where it be. And so then if you notice there, water to the ankles, make your applications there. And then he goes another 1,000, and it's to the knees, verse 4. Then it's up to the loins, and finally in verse 5, water to swim in. And that whole chapter just makes a Zechariah 14:8-9. The old Assyrian Empire was way up in this, around this Caspian, on over into where Iran and all of that is, where the Babylon, that was where they were down along the first.
It almost took them that long to travel along this for 10 years, huh?
Just about.
Didn't the Assyrians take the Northern Sea?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, but the Babylonians took the southern. Three attacks upon the southern.
But they had all, yeah, the Babylonians had already taken care of.